All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for coming out. I'm excited to be here today and talk to you a little bit about things that I love, plants and then pollinators that we all love and care about. And have a picture starting off here, of course, a honeybee here pollinating a crocus. I'm going to talk a little bit about honeybees, but I want to talk about a bunch of other things, too. Some of the cool stories with pollinators, some of the crazy relationships that pollinators have with plants, and then at the end bring it around to sort of some things that we can do in our own gardens at home and our landscapes to support pollinators and help improve, you know, the populations of these insects. So obviously we all know bees and hummingbirds and butterflies and stuff, but there's lots and lots of other really crazy, interesting, cool pollinators that I'm kind of obsessed with. And I want to tell you some of my favorite pollinator stories. This is a fig, of course. Figs is a huge, diverse genus. We know the edible figs, but there's all kinds of other figs. If you're in the tropics, you see figs everywhere. They have all these bizarre fruits. And figs are really bizarre because of all the hundreds of species of fig, each species of fig has its own species of fig wasp. So each species of fig, it's a particular wasp that only pollinates that particular species of fig. And they have this incredibly close relationship that's developed over evolutionary time. Whenever a fig evolves into a new species, the wasp has to evolve right along with it in order to pollinate these really bizarre fig fruits. And the story of how this gets pollinated is so bizarre, it may turn you off from eating figs. I think figs are kind of disgusting, honestly. But when I go through this, figs you buy at the grocery store have not been pollinated. They'll develop a ripe fruit without seeds, without pollination. So don't worry, none of this happened inside of the figs you're eating. But a fig is actually like an inside-out flower. The center of the fig, the flowers are inside of that. And as the fig is developing, as you see here, it starts to develop, and a female wasp covered in pollen flies into the fig, crawls inside of it, and goes all around the inside of the fig and pollinates all the female flowers in that fig. Then she dies, again, inside the fig. She lays eggs inside the fig and dies. Those eggs hatch into a bunch of little larvae. These baby wasps develop inside the fig as the fig fruit itself is developing and ripening. And then when those wasps emerge, they reach adult size. They are, again, inside the fig. They have their whole life basically happens inside of this fig. Inside the fig, they come out, and right at where the exit is, where the female came in, the male flowers develop and release their pollen. And that the pollen is... development is timed perfectly so when the fig wasps are fully mature and ready to leave, the pollen is there waiting. So as they exit the fig, they get covered with pollen. They mate, the males then die, that's it, and then the female flies off to another immature fig, crawls inside, and pollinates that. So their whole life cycle takes place inside of this fig fruit. They're molting, they're eating, they're doing everything inside of the fruit, and then they're flying off for basically just a little bit, a few days, they're outside the fig before she crawls in another one, lays eggs, and dies. So this relationship is incredibly intimate. The figs cannot survive without the fig wasps, and the fig wasps cannot survive without the fig. And it has to be so species-specific, because if the fig group was fruit, was developing a little bit faster or a little bit slower, the timing wouldn't be right. The pollen wouldn't be ready. The flowers wouldn't be ready. It has to be perfectly in sync with these wasps that are developing inside the fig. So there's all these crazy stories. And figs, of course, are very exotic and tropical. And there's stuff that's very close to home that's a little bit more bizarre than you maybe think it is. This is oriental poppy, very common in gardens. You know, they start flowering in early summer. And these poppies have these big black spots on the petals. You may have wondered, maybe have thought about why is that? Why are there big black blotches on the petals of poppies? So I'm going to make an analogy here. Bear with me. I say that those big black spots on poppy petals are roughly equivalent to women in beer commercials, okay? Those women have nothing to do with beer, but they're a thing that beer companies use to trick straight men into buying beer. Poppies are doing the exact same thing with these spots on their petals. So these poppies, when they bloom and where they're native in Eastern Europe and in Asia, there's beetles that pollinate these. The female beetles just fly around, they land inside a poppy, and just hang out eating the pollen. So they're not really good at pollinating the flowers because they don't fly from flower to flower. They just sit there chowing down on the pollen. The male beetles, on the other hand, are looking for the females. So they're flying around, and they look down into a poppy, and they see a black spot, and they think, oh, that must be a beetle in that flower. they fly down, and it's just a spot on the petal. So then they have to fly to the next poppy and the next poppy, and they have to land inside of each one and look to make sure whether that's a spot or an actual female beetle. So in the process, they're pollinating the poppies. So unlike where the figs and figs wasps, this was like a very mutually beneficial thing. They both need each other. The wasps get a home, the fig gets pollinated. This is a little more exploitative. The poppy is sort of taking advantage of what the beetles are doing and getting pollinated. These poppies are not unique in this. There's a lot of plants, actually, that have sort of done this. And it starts becoming an arms race because the beetles will need, you know, evolutionarily won't need to figure out if that's a spot or a female. And then the plants need to keep fooling them. So the mimicries get more and more advanced. This is a daisy from South Africa. And you can see their black spots now have little white spots to mimic the shine of the sun glinting off the shiny backs, in this case of flies, that pollinate these daisies. Not only that, but the number of spots, as you can see, is irregular. Sometimes there's one, sometimes there's two, sometimes there's three. So again, even if the flies are looking and they see, oh, well, there's two spots and there should be only one, one of them must be a female, now the number of spots is unpredictable. So the flies keep getting fooled. And keep having to fly down and check out and see whether that's a female or just a spot. And in the process, are going from flower to flower, bringing pollen with them. The most elaborate one of these are a genus of orchids, which are native to Western Europe. These are called the bee orchids, and they have the most elaborate mimicry of a female insect that you will ever see. So that's the lower petal of that orchid. It's got stripes like the bee, it's got fuzz like the bee, it's got little spots for the eyes like the bee. It looks so much like the female bee. and they have this very interesting thing where this is a solitary bee, and the males emerge ready to mate like a week or two before the females are out there. And the orchids bloom in that window when there's a couple weeks when the males are out looking for females, but there's no females yet out to actually mate with. So the bees fly around getting fooled by these flowers. As soon as they see an actual female, the game is up. They figured it out. They don't visit the orchids anymore. So the timing is very precise. And again, these orchids have a close relationship with just one specific species of bee. Each orchid has its own kind of bee because the mimicry is so precise that the other bees aren't fooled. So each of these orchids has evolved to take advantage of one specific species of bee that pollinates it. Interestingly, there's one of these species where the bee that pollinates it is actually now extinct. The orchid is still sort of persisting by division. It doesn't set seed very much, but it's sort of persisting as a species. But scientists actually have a description of what that bee must have looked like, because they can look at the flower and see, well, it must have had stripes here and fuzz here and spots here, because there's almost a picture of that bee preserved in the shape of this orchid growing in the grasslands there in Europe. And then there's some of these things that are a little more familiar, a little more mundane. You've seen Queen Anne's lace, which is wild carrots growing by the roadside, and you may have noticed they often have right in the center one big black flower surrounded by all the white ones. If you've looked closely at Queen Anne's lace, you'll often see there's spiders and wasps. They're eating things that are coming to pollinate it. There's some things coming for pollinating and other things taking advantage of them to have a meal. This is a little fake insect that a wasp or a wasp usually that's looking for prey. It thinks, oh, maybe that's a fly trying to pollinate this Queen Anne's lace, flies down to kill it. It's just a black flower, and so it's flying from Queen Anne's lace to Queen Anne's lace, looking for food and accidentally pollinating us along the way. So a lot of flowers that seem very familiar and mundane actually have these crazy backstories of bizarre, intimate things, these long evolutionary of plants taking advantage of insects and vice versa, that you wouldn't realize just looking at the plants. And then there's things that are familiar. We all love hummingbirds, of course. and it's really interesting when you start talking about hummingbirds that you can see the way that hummingbirds and bees have changed through the coevolution of the species that they're pollinated. So what we see here on the left are flowers pollinated by bees, and on the right are flowers pollinated by hummingbirds. And each of those pairs are closely related species. Those are two species of petunia, two species of mimulus or monkey flower, and at the bottom, two species of salvia. And on the left, that's the bee-pollinated ones, right, hummingbird. And you can see that they're, you know, the structures of the flower are similar, but there's a suite of characteristics. It's called pollinator syndrome that come together as the plants adapt to be pollinated by a specific thing. So the bee flowers are pinks, blues, purples, those colors. They have these broad spreading petals that the bees can land on so they can get in to pollinate them. and they tend to have shorter flowers so the bees can reach down and get the nectar in the flower. Hummingbird flowers, they're red. You already know that, right? You've seen red flowers consistently. The petals, instead of being broad and spreading, are tend to be reflexed or narrow because the hummingbirds don't have to land. They can hover. And the flowers are often very long because the hummingbirds can reach down with that long beak and get the nectar. So you see these sort of imprint of the relationship between the plant and the pollinator in the shape of the flower and the structure of the flower. And it's very consistent. And it's interesting to think about, well, what are all those things doing? Why are the flowers shaped that way? Why do all these characteristics come together in a plant that's being pollinated by a bee or a hummingbird? and there's some really interesting research I'm going to walk you through that I love that sort of tried to untangle some of how these different characteristics come together. So this is work done by Doug Shimsky, who's now at Michigan State, actually. And he was curious about these mimulus, these two species. They're closely related, very similar ranges in western U.S., but they are completely different because they're pollinated by hummingbirds and bees, respectively. So what he did is he hybridized those two species. So A and B, those are the two parent species, and then all of these are hybrids between the two species. So when you hybridize them, you're taking all the genes and all the traits of the two species, shuffling them up into new combinations. And you can see then, for example, we have this one here that is the shape of a hummingbird flower, but it's colored like a bee-pollinated flower, or vice versa here. So you can there's sort of this combination of different traits, and it allows the researchers to try to figure out how are these things interacting with the pollinators? How are the pollinators reacting to shape and color and size? And also, you can't see this visually, but nectar production. Hummingbird-pollinated flowers have lots and lots of nectar, whereas the bee-pollinated ones produce much less. So they wanted to see how do these different factors interact with the pollinators. So what they did is they took hundreds of these different individual plants, put them out in the field, and then this is why faculty have graduate students. I don't know if you realize this. So they could set them out in the field, and the graduate students had to sit there and count every bee and hummingbird as it came to these flowers. So they're sitting there, one bee, one hummingbird, counting which pollinator was visiting which flower. And then they could see what is it that's actually attracting the pollinators. Is it the shape? Is it the color? What is the factor that draws these in? What they found with hummingbirds was there's only one thing the hummingbirds were interested in. They didn't care about color. They didn't care about shape. They just cared about nectar. And what they actually realized is the hummingbirds, when they showed up with 100 new plants in this field, they visited each plant once and noticed how much nectar they got, memorized the location of the high nectar plants, and came back to those plants. So if someone calls you bird brain, it's maybe not as insult as you think, because these hummingbirds memorize an incredibly complex map of where plants are, how much nectar they're getting out of them, which if you have a hummingbird feeder, you know this, right? Because if you don't get it out soon enough in the spring, they come back from their winter migration, and they're sitting there waiting, like, where's my... Because they remember that there was a hummingbird feeder here last year. So they have this incredible ability to memorize precise locations of plants, and they're just going for the ones that have lots of nectar. The bees, on the other hand, had a different reaction. So the bees, they found, went to the ones that you would expect, the ones that were the pink ones with the broad petals, the pink colors that they could see easily and the broad petals that they could land on. And they didn't have that precise, differentiation in the amount of nectar. So the two different things reacted very differently to these flowers. And part of that difference goes into the difference of the way bees and hummingbirds find food. Hummingbirds are individuals that go out and memorize locations. Lots of bees live in colonies where they actually communicate with the other bees in the colony. So people heard of the waggle dance? Does anyone know what the waggle dance is? A couple of you. So this is the crazy thing where bees communicate by running in circles and shaking their bodies to communicate what direction the food is. And they will they're running this figure eight pattern, and where the direction that they're pointing tells the bees what direction to fly. And then they shake their bodies. And if they shake slowly, that means there's a little food there. If they shake really fast, it means there's a lot of food there. It's really, really good. You've got to run over there. So they communicate. And so one bee finds this field of flowers. They come back to the hive and tell everybody else, hey, go over there. And they get the other bees to that field, but they don't have the fine-tuning to say, well, the second plant from the right had lots of nectar, but the third one over wasn't so good. They're just getting the other bees to that field. And so the other bees show up, and they go for the ones that's easiest for them to see and easiest for them to land on. So there's a real difference between how different pollinators see the world and interact with the world that shapes the changes how the plants develop, the shape of the flowers, the color of the flowers, how they're growing, everything that they're doing in their relationship with these pollinators. But that begs a question, or at least to me. So I just said that hummingbirds don't care about what the flower looks like. They don't care about the shape. All they want is something with lots of nectar. Hummingbird flowers are consistently red. I showed you in the picture that they're consistently red. There's the same shape all the time. And if you ask why hummingbird flowers are red, this is my answer, and there's the research that supports this, that it's camouflage, that the flowers are actually hiding from bees rather than trying to attract hummingbirds. But let me walk you through that. And we're going to go skidding off into the weeds here a little bit, but I'll come back to pollinators. We talk about color and light. We think of the world as being the color it is because that's how our eyes work. And we call this section of radiation visible light because that's what our eyes see. Birds see very similarly to us. They have a pretty similar color vision. Insects don't, however, especially bees. So we call light we can't see on one end ultraviolet and the light that we can't see on the other end infrared. Bees can see further into ultraviolet than we can. So there's light that's completely invisible to us that we don't even see that insects and bees can see. And then the red end of the spectrum, they can't see. So what we call red to a bee is infrared. It's invisible light that they can't see or perceive or tell is there. And people do these really cool pictures with ultraviolet cameras. So because this is, Rudbeckia, black-eyed Susan, and then on the bottom there, it's what it looks like under ultraviolet light. So lots of flowers have ultraviolet pigments in them. They're invisible to us. They're invisible to birds, but the insects can see them. So they have patterns. They have lines. They have spots. They have all this decoration on them that are visible to the insect pollinators that whole flower has evolved to attract. whereas, the hummingbirds can't see that just like us. And the red colors in those flowers, again, are invisible to the insects. So that brightly colored red flower that we see right away popping up against the foliage, the bees are not even perceiving that. It's almost invisible to them. In the interest of time, I'll skip some of this. But you have to wonder. So I've just made this case that here's another species pair. These are lobelias, Lobelia cardinalis, which is the cardinal flower, red for hummingbirds, closely related Lobelia syphilitica, bee-pollinated flower. So the Lobelia with the blue flowers is blue. The bees can see that color. They're attracted to it. They can find it. They go in and pollinate it. Whereas that bright red flower that we see so easily, the hummingbird sees so easily, is almost invisible to the bees. But you have to, the next question then becomes, why are they trying to hide from the bees, right? Isn't the whole point of the flower to be pollinated, to attract the pollinators in? What's the point of hiding from the bees and only being visible to the hummingbirds? Well, if you look at the structure of the flower, they kind of have to make a choice because they can't be effectively pollinated by both. So on these lobelias, the pollen is up on this weird hook thing. So you see it's up on this little hook. That's where the pollen is, held way up above the flower. On this one, that same hook, but it's much, much lower down. So you can see when a bee crawls into this flower, the blue one, that pollen is positioned to rub that pollen right along its back. So when it goes to the next flower, it's carrying the pollen to pollinate that flower. If a bee goes to this flower, the pollen's way up in the air. It's nowhere near the bee. So it's a waste of time and a waste of nectar. Bee's going to come in, drink the nectar, and not catch any pollen and not do the plant any good at all. And vice versa. A hummingbird on this flower might get a tiny bit of pollen on its beak, but here the pollen is up where it's going to get that pollen right on the hummingbird's head, where it's going to stick to the feathers and carry it to the next flower. So a lot of plants through evolutionary time have sort of thrown their lot in with one pollinator or the other. And then they want to keep the other pollinators away so that they're saving their nectar so that it can be eaten by so they're sort of trading nectar for pollination, and they want to give it to the pollinator that's actually going to do the job, not waste it on some bee. So a lot of the structure of a hummingbird-pollinated flower, it's visible to the hummingbirds because it's red, but more, it's hard for the bees to see. The petals are narrow, so the bees have nowhere to land. It's got the long trumpet, so the bees can't get down and get to the nectar. It's like big keep out signs to the bees so the pollen is there waiting for the hummingbirds when they come and visit that flower. And there's lots of flowers that do variants of this. So you snapdragons, we know, very familiar. They have that weird closed up flower. Only large, strong bees can pull that flower open. So flies and other things that might want to eat the nectar and not pollinate it effectively, or even honeybees. Honeybees are not strong enough to pull this open. It's only the larger bumblebees and carpenter bees that can get that flower in and pull those petals open and actually pollinate that flower. Another familiar example, tomatoes and eggplants. This may not be obvious, but if you've ever picked a lily or something, you know the pollen is right out there. It gets on your clothes and stains them. On a tomato, if you look at it, there's no loose pollen. The pollen is wrapped up in these little tight packages. It's not available to be eaten. Lots of things like to eat pollen. It's high in protein. It's very nutritious. These are what's called buzz pollinated. And if you hear bees visiting tomatoes, eggplants, and quite a number of other flowers, actually, they'll be flying along, bzzz, they'll land on the flower, and the note will change. It'll be bzzz, bzzz. And then they'll go to the next flower, and again, when they land, they buzz at this higher frequency. And what they're doing is they're vibrating that flower, and that shakes the pollen out of these little packages so that they can get at it. So that pollen is locked up tight. It's not accessible to other things except for bees that know the right frequency. You can actually do this if you have a tuning fork. You get that vibrating and touch it to a tomato or eggplant flower. The pollen comes shooting out. It's pretty cool, unless the bees already beat you to it. So lots of flowers have these strategies to keep their pollen and nectar away from things that want to eat it that aren't going to pollinate them and sort of save it for the things that are going to pollinate it effectively. And then, of course, it goes the other way. So in the natural world, it's always an arms race. Things are trying to figure out ways around it. So this is what's called nectar robbing. This bee here has bitten a hole in the base of the salvia flower. His tongue's not long enough. If he goes in the front here, he cannot reach the nectar at the base. So they bite holes in the sides of the flowers so they can just reach in and get the nectar. Obviously doing the flower no good at all. It's not coming near the pollen. It's just biting in and getting the nectar. So this is a hummingbird-pollinated species of salvia from South America. And you'll see this a lot if you're growing something. We grow some of these tropical salvias as annuals in our gardens. And the hummingbird species that they co-evolved with, we don't have here. And there's a lot of nectar sitting there. And after a while, the bees will figure out a way to get at it. So there's always this back and forth. The plants are, you know, evolving better protections to their nectar, and then the bees are saying, well, I can chew a hole here, I can do this. So if you've ever grown, you know the salvia black and blue has these beautiful blue flowers? If you've grown it, you may notice. Some people say it's a great hummingbird flower, and it's always hummingbirds on it. Some people say it's not. And it really depends on who got to it first. If the hummingbirds get to it first, they'll be there collecting all the nectar. If your carpenter bees or bumblebees find it first, they'll bite holes in all the flowers, take all the nectar. When the hummingbirds show up, there's no nectar, so they don't bother coming back. So sometimes these things play out in weird ways in the garden as the plants and insects interact. So as we talk through these things, we talked a lot about hummingbirds and bee-pollinated flowers. Each pollinator has sort of a suite of characteristics that go with that plant. And you look at a flower, you can often see what the pollinator must be. So this is a wild species of Petunia axillaris. And this is very typical of a moth-pollinated flower, night-flying moths. So the broad white petals are very visible in dusk when these moths are active. They're very fragrant in the nighttime, but not during the day. So they have the scent in the evening, so these night-flying moths can find them, and very long tubes. And you'll see there's lots of big white flowers that are fragrant at night, and those often go together because those are the traits that are, you know, pollinated by these moths. There's also the gross ones. There's a whole bunch of plants that are pollinated by carrion flies. This is Stapelia. It's grown often as a house plant, and they have a very good imitation of rotting meat. They smell like something died. They're obnoxious. They really stink. And of course, the flies come to that smell of rotting meat, and then they have a whole imitation of a dead animal. It's hairy, it's brown, and they crawl in there trying to lay eggs and pollinate the flower sort of on their way. Our native version of that is skunk cabbage. If you've seen our native skunk cabbages in the spring, they're brown and mottled and pretty stinky, and again, they're being pollinated by carrion flies. They actually produce heat, so they're warm like a rotting animal would be. It's pretty gross, kind of cool in a gross way. So there's all these different flowers and plants that have created these whole elaborate relationships with their pollinators. Some of them get really bizarre and interesting. This is one of my favorite little ones. This is a euglossid bee. This is a tropical species of bee, and they have the weirdest relationship with this orchid. This is the male bee. He's very shiny, and the females congregate in these big areas, and then the males fly in and try to mate with them. And if the male just shows up, the females will have nothing to do with him, unless he visits this orchid first, and the orchid produced this like paste, this fragrant paste that he smears over his body for all the world like perfume, and then he flies off and the females will mate with him. It's not really clear if there's some function to that. There's some thought that maybe it's like antibacterial or somehow beneficial to the bees to have this paste smeared over them. But it's sort of become integral to the mating of these bees. They cannot mate with the females until they've visited these orchids. And while they're using the orchids, you know, to get laid, they're, of course, pollinating the orchids. It's sort of similar to the way that humans use some flowers, you know, roses we use in similar ways sometimes. but you think about roses, I want to stop here. We talked about all these different shapes and structures of flowers and what the pollinator is that has created that through evolutionary time. So you look at a rose, lots of petals, it's very fragrant, it's kind of unusual looking flower if you think about it. And if you want to know what created this, what's the pollinator that made the rose look like this way, it's people. people, wild roses look like this. We started with this little thing, and people started finding forms with extra petals and bigger flowers and fragrance and more colors and all this stuff. And through a very long history of humans selecting and breeding and growing roses in our gardens, we've transformed them into this completely novel flower that's really, we're the pollinators, and our gardens are the pollinators rather than some wild insect that's pollinating them. that's sort of my little tour through some of like the crazy things that are happening, and just to appreciate the sheer diversity and fascinating aspects of, you know, these complex interactions between plants and their pollinators. I wanted to bring it back now to sort of the practical stuff and some of the stuff that's in the news. I'm sure you've heard about colony collapse disorder with honeybees, that there's a big decline in the honeybee population, which is obviously of a lot of concern. Particularly economically, we rely on honeybees to pollinate a lot of our crops, a lot of our tree fruits and stuff rely on honeybees. and it's becoming a problem. It's getting more and more difficult to get bees in to pollinate these crops. So it's definitely a big economic problem for a lot of these crops. And there's a lot of factors that are going into colony collapse disorder in particular. There's viruses and bacteria and insecticides and loss of habitat and a whole suite of things that are coming together that the modern theories are. It's not one thing that's killing honeybees. It's a whole constellation of factors that are making it difficult for them to survive. And that definitely has big economic impacts for crops like apples. Things like corn, of course, are not pollinated by bees. They're wind pollinated, so they get away with it. But that's part of what's causing the decline of bees and some of the other pollinators is we have these big sweeps of just corn, which is not good food for basically almost very few insects, and it's becoming harder for these wild insects to forage and find food. With the specific case of honeybees, which you've heard about, it's a really big economic problem because our agriculture depends on them. In that specific case, it's not so much an ecological problem because honeybees are not native here. This is their native range of honeybees. They're an introduced species here, brought over for honey and then became, you know, the wild bees or feral or invasive species, actually. So the decline of honeybees here in the U.S. is not so much an ecological crisis as it is an economic crisis of how we do agriculture because we rely so much on that particular species to pollinate. But of course, we have lots and lots of other species of bees, native species of bees, that aren't quite as sexy and don't get as much press as honeybees, but are pretty cool all the same. This is a leafcutter bee. If you've seen on a leaf, they love red buds. They'll cut like a perfect little circle out of the leaf. You see these little like perfect cookie cutter cuts out of leaves, and that's leafcutter bees. They take these and roll them up to make these little nests, which they pack full of pollen and nectar and then lay eggs inside of them. So the larva, the baby, develop inside of these nests that they've made from these leaves. So it's one of many, many really cool, interesting native species of bees. And many of the native species of bees are suffering similar declines for similar reasons as the honeybees that get a lot more of the sort of attention in the news. And of course, you've probably heard of monarch butterflies. That's the other big, sexy species that people love to talk about. They're very cool, the way they migrate. They're so beautiful. And we've seen populations declining in recent years. So last year, they had a little bit of uptick, which is good news. But species like monarch butterflies and honeybees often sort of take up all the air. That's what everyone wants to talk about because they're the familiar ones, the sort of sexy species. But there's tons and tons and tons of other species of interesting pollinators from bees and wasps and flies and butterflies and moths. That are also sort of facing similar problems that the bees are. and as I said, one of the big things that's sort of a face a problem. Sort of one of the fundamental things that's hard for some of these species, native species, is that we've cleared a lot of natural habitat and replaced it with big fields of corn and soybeans, which are not great habitat for a lot of insects. The other thing that we've done is we've cleared a lot of natural habitat and turned it into lawn. And your perfect green lawn without a weed in sight is probably even worse habitat for most everything than a cornfield. You know, we've sort of, when we strip out the diversity of lots of flowering plants and just make, you know, a sea of bluegrass without a flower, that's not very good habitat for a lot of insects. And so we've sort of taken away a lot of the places where these insects could grow and feed and develop. So I want to talk through a couple things that we can do at home, you as like home gardeners, homeowners, can do to help support this great diversity of pollinators. And I really break it down, you know, simply to two main things that you can do. And the first thing you can do is avoid insecticides. And that includes organic insecticides. And I think sometimes we think, oh, it's organic, it can't hurt anything. If it's a spray that kills insects, then it kills insects. And it really doesn't matter whether it was organic or synthetic. If you spray it on your plants, it's going to kill the insects. So if you can avoid, especially, you know, if you're a farmer and your paycheck is coming from that crop, it's a little harder to do the math of like, well, can I afford not to spray or not and stuff. But certainly as homeowners, we can afford to have some holes in the leaves of our plants and tolerate a few aphids or something and avoid using insecticides that we really don't need to do. If you absolutely do have to use an insecticide, the rule of thumb is get something that's going to kill the fewest number of things. So look on the label, and it'll say what it kills. And if it's a list of, you know, 50 different species, that's just going to, like, carpet bomb your garden and kill everything. You want something that you're trying to kill aphids, find something that says kills aphids and mealybugs, and that's all that's on the label. And then you're more likely to not do damage to sort of the larger ecosystem. So that's sort of the rule of thumb. Please, you know, if you can, just don't. Just be patient and tolerate a little insect damage. And if you have to, be as targeted as you can to just control the actual problem, not everything else in your garden. And when you do that, of course, all kinds of cool things pop up. And then, you know, we all know natural predators. Praying mantis are like the big sexy natural predator that are gobbling up all kinds of things in your garden. They're very cool. They're not very effective, actually, at eating pests. They eat mostly big flies and bees. Aphids are too small to be a meal for that. But there are lots and lots of interesting insects. If you stop spraying, they'll come into your garden and start eating the things that are causing you problems. Toads and frogs are really effective at controlling a lot of things. This is at the nursery where I used to work, Arrowhead Alpines. This toad loved to bury himself in the pots because it was more soil. A little disruptive, but perfectly happy to have him here because he was cheap insect control. And if you see frogs and toads in your garden, that's always a good sign because amphibians are notoriously sensitive to a lot of chemicals in the environment. So whenever you see amphibians, that's a great sign that you're doing things right and things are healthy in the garden. And they love slugs, which is always a good thing. And then you'll get sort of weird natural predators that'll show up. So this is tomato hornworm. If you've grown tomatoes, you definitely know you've seen, like, you come out one day and like half the tomato's been defoliated because these huge green caterpillars are eating it. This one has been parasitized. So each of those little white things is a wasp pupa. There's wasps that lay eggs inside the caterpillar. It's so gross and cool at the same time. They develop inside the caterpillar and then come out and pupate, and an adult wasp will come out of each of those, and the caterpillar will die. There's lots and lots of wasps that do this. Some of them are tiny. There's wasps that lay eggs inside of aphids. You know, an aphid you can barely see. These wasps are almost microscopic. So there's a whole host, you know, of interesting insects that will come and start dealing with your problem. So sometimes if you see something eating your plants, if you can step back for a second and be patient, there's probably something that's going to come along and start eating that. This was a crazy thing that happened in my old house when I lived in Lansing. So I had these chairs on the front porch, which has these little holes drilled in decorative patterns. You can see some of the holes are plugged with mud, and there's something in there. This is a little solitary wasp. And she has there, that's a cabbage worm. Those little green caterpillars you see in your cabbage. She has taken a cabbage worm. She stings it, which paralyzes it. She stuffs it in this hole that she finds holes, you know, woodpecker holes and stuff. But my chair on my porch happened to be the perfect size for this. She stuffs it in there. She lays an egg on top of it, plugs the top up with mud, and then the baby wasps develop eating that caterpillar that she stuffed down inside that hole. When I worked at the nursery, they loved the spigots where the irrigation, the sprinklers actually, were just the right size for some of these wasps. And they'd always be like stuffing them full of caterpillars, which was cool and then annoying because you turn on the water and nothing would come out or caterpillars would come flying out, which is exciting too. So sometimes, you know, we as gardeners, we're like growing something and we see aphids, we see cabbage worms, and our instinct is we got to get that off our plants. And if you can be patient and step back, that's a lot of good food, and things will come in and start eating it. And you pay attention, they can be really cool and interesting in their own right. So the other thing that I think is really important that we can do, as you know, in our own homes, is increase the diversity in our gardens, growing more different things. So if your whole lawn is bluegrass, Japanese beetles love that, and there's a few other things that want to eat that, but there's not a lot of diversity of different insects that can survive on just, you know, one species. And whenever you can add more diversity to the space where you live, you're going to support a better diversity of insects and pollinators of all types. And if you can, adding native species is always great because they have a longer evolutionary relationship with our native species of insects. I don't take a, like, you need to rip out your non-native species. As long as it's not invasive, it's not doing any harm. But adding more, I'd say, rather than don't pull out your exotics and add natives and add more diversity to your garden will create a more diverse ecosystem of pollinators and also help support some of those predators, which will help reduce disease insect problems. And that comes back to what I was talking about. As we talked about through all these flowers, often they have very specific relationships with insects. And when you add something new, you're adding new species of pollinators to your garden as well. And then there's things that are eating those pollinators and things that are eating the things that are eating those pollinators. And as you add diversity, you're building up that base of diversity to create a complex, rich ecosystem in your own garden. And sometimes you get really bizarre things that'll show up. This is the caterpillar of the pipevine swallowtail. So you all know that monarchs only feed on milkweed. Lots of butterflies have very specific relationships with their host plants. This only feeds on the pipevine, a genus Aristolochia, which is not very common up here. It's a native species, but not common in Michigan. But if you plant it, then these pipevine swallowtails will show up and start devouring it. And sometimes it'll be a few years before one blows in and finds it. And they're really beautiful butterflies. They have these very gorgeous butterflies. When they're open, the back of the wings are this metallic blue. They're gorgeous, and they tend to stay right around where they're feeding. So when you add that species to your garden, you suddenly add this beautiful butterfly that you just wouldn't have otherwise. And that's the case more often than not. Lots and lots of butterflies and moths have these very specific relationships. So when you add something new to your garden, you're going to bring in so much more diversity of pollinators into the garden as well. So I just want to say that this is, if you're a gardener like me who loves to go to the nursery and stuff the car with as many plants as you can, now you have justification. It's for the environment. You need to have more diversity in your garden. So when you go to the nursery and you buy everything, you're just helping the pollinators. wrap up here quickly, Relentless Self-Promotion. This is my book. All right, well, thank you so much.